The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
A couple of announcements. The thing about hunger in Silicon Valley, it's quite phenomenal how much there actually is. You wouldn't think of it in a place like this. And I know a little bit about it because my son was in eighth grade. He did a 10-minute documentary on called The Power of Generosity, the Fighting Hunger in Silicon Valley, that won an award. And he went around to Second Harvest, and he went to Soup Kitchen San Jose, and then he went along with a pastor. He went down to some warehouse district Saturday morning, early was dark, down in San Jose, and the back room of some ceramic shop, they had a room, and they made all these sandwiches. And then he went along with the pastor with all these bag lunches to the homeless encampments in Guadalupe River. And they passed out these lunches. And so he made a documentary of that whole thing. And you could see it on YouTube. It's called The Power of Generosity. And you also get some of the statistics there of how many people are hungry locally. So that's and the second one is that we're quite fortunate to have Shinzen Young teach here this coming Saturday. He's one of the senior Dharma teachers in America. Quite a dynamic man, and very interesting in what he kind of his inventive mind about around meditation. And he is when he was invited, when he said he'd come and do a day long, he said he wanted to do an advanced day long on breath meditation. And so you're supposed to be a little bit advanced to come. So I don't know, there's some statement there. So it's not really meant for beginners. And not only that, but he wants people to read something ahead of time. So I think if you go on our website and the special events, maybe there's a link to the things to read. He wants people to be prepared. And so anyway, it should be quite a wonderful event on Saturday. So the topics for today's talk are love, faith, refuge, spiritual purification, and the ability to know for yourself what is true or know what's spiritually true. It's quite a combination of topics. And they come together very beautifully in a relatively short discourse of the Buddha from the middle-length discourses called the Discourse on the Simile of the Cloth. And so I'd like to... It's one of my favorite little discourses by the Buddha, and I want to present this discourse, both the little story that's it's housed in and then the teachings itself. And one of the things, there's a number of things I like about this discourse, but one about it is what it says about refuge. For those of you who don't know, one of the primary expressions of faith, professions of faith, if we use kind of maybe Western religious terminology, is going for refuge. And the idea is refuge here means some place that you can go for support, for inspiration, the tradition says it involves knowledge, understanding about what is spiritually efficacious. It's a knowledge about something which gives us an emotional, heartfelt connection to the spiritual life that we have in Buddhism. And it also is motivational. It's what motivates people to engage in the kind of the Buddhist life. And the word refuge, you know, implies support, it implies protection and inspiration. And there are said to be three refuges that we go for support to, or inspiration to, and that is the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. Sangha being the community of people who have borne witness to what the Buddha was teaching. And it's one of the most common rituals in much of Buddhism, probably all of Buddhism, is to go a little ritual of the triple refuge, where people go and recite the refuges and take the refuges. And in fact, this ritual seems to go back to the Buddha, because lots of stories of people hearing the Buddha's teachings, and the end of those teachings being so inspired that they declare in his presence, I go for refuge now in you, in the Dharma, and in the Sangha. An interesting phenomenon, though, is, in these ancient texts, is nowhere does the Buddha ever advise anyone or instruct anyone to go for refuge. He never says, you know, this is a good idea, you should do this. So it's something the tradition and his followers have adopted ever since. But he doesn't actually tell people to do it. I've kind of scanned through this early collection of his teachings, and I've only found two central places where the Buddha gives instructions around refuge. The Pali word is sarana. And the first has to do with his teachings teachings he gave near the end of his life. And there he says, make yourself a refuge. Make yourself an island by practicing the four foundations of mindfulness. So don't go for refuge, make yourself a refuge. Be a refuge for yourself in this time. So you become your own support, your own inspiration. Something about yourself here that can have this kind of same level of protection, support, inspiration, motivation, understanding, that you'd go for refuge in yourself. Very positive view of the human being, our capacity. The second has to do with this discourse that I'm going to refer to today. And here, the instruction here he gives is make yourself a refuge for all beings. That's a big difference, huh? Between, you know, I'm going to go for refuge in the Buddha versus I'm going to make myself a refuge for all beings. And so I think it's kind of meaningful that if you actually listen to the teachings of the Buddha, what he's telling, what he wants people to do is to become a refuge themselves. So what does it take to become a refuge oneself, and what does it take to become a refuge, a support, a protection, an inspiration for others? For all, it doesn't say some others, it says for all beings. Quite a great thing, right? So the story connected to this discourse is the Buddha is living or staying for a while next to a river called the Bahuka River in northern India. And it seems that this river was one of the sacred rivers of the time. And sacred meant that people would go into the river to purify themselves. So a kind of spiritual purification. And if you had done bad deeds and needed to purify your karma, you can go into the river and get it all washed away. And so a Brahmin, probably a Brahmin priest who kind of belongs to a religious tradition that believes in this kind of purification by outside sources, purification by the river, sees the Buddha residing near the river, and he says to the Buddha, do you go bathing in that river? And the Buddha says, why should I go bathing in that river? What would the river do for me? And the Brahmin says, the river is held by many to give liberation. It is held by many to give merit. And many wash away their evil actions in the Bahuka River. So it's a pretty promising. We should go there ourselves. If it really is up to, you know, what people say. And then the Buddha responds in this following kind of poem or ballad. I'll abbreviate a little bit. A fool may bathe there forever, yet will not purify dark deeds. What could a sacred river bring to pass? It cannot purify an evildoer, a person who has done cruel and brutal deeds. One pure in heart has evermore the festival of spring, the holy day. One fair in act, one beautiful in action, one pure in heart brings virtue to perfection. It is here, Brahman, that you should bathe, to make yourself a refuge for all beings. And if you speak no falsehood, nor work harm for living beings, nor take what is offered not, with faith and free from avarice, what need for you to bathe in the river. For then any well will be your sacred river. So here he's pointing to the heart, the quality, the purity of one's heart, purity of one's action, as being the sacred river, as a place that we purify. And if you do that, if you purify your own heart, then you become a refuge for all beings. So rather than externalizing spirituality, it internalizes it. And this is one of the movements that the Buddha did compared to some of the religious traditions of his time. And I suspect that we can also see that happening for us, that it's not so difficult to consider the ways in which people look for something outside of themselves as the answer, as the place for their spiritual liberation, spiritual well-being, or just their psychological well-being, that they attribute it, something else is going to do it for me. And you know, many people come to me and talk to me about the things they do, and it's quite remarkable the wide range of things that people are very sincerely trying to do, but there are ways in which they're looking outside of them for some solution. And for a while here in Silicon Valley, I don't know if it's an attribute to Silicon Valley, there was kind of a trend for a while, I thought, for people who thought that they were get these meditation machines, that you would wire yourself up in electrodes and have certain sounds that you would listen to, and it would put you into this really good meditative state. It would get you into deep samadhi. There's a neighbor here on Birch Street who was an architect for John Lilly, building, I think, the first business in San Francisco for samadhi tanks in the 1970s. You put yourself in this tank and this deep samadhi. This samadhi was kind of treated as an external thing. You do this thing that you could put you in a good state. A popular one external thing, the river that some people go to, is drugs. And some people have a lot of faith in power of hallucinogenic drugs for, you know, for attaining spiritual states. Or some people do it oddly, but with meditation itself, or even meditation retreats. They treat meditation retreats as the thing that's going to purify them, that's going to save them, that's going to cure them. But there's a kind of way in which they treat it externally, outside of themselves. And I did that in the very beginning of my Buddhist practice. I was kind of enamored with Buddhism, and saw Buddhism as this great world religion, this great authority figure, this great big thing, this great power or something. And, you know, little old me, you know, had to somehow learn and enter into and get in touch with that big Buddhist thing. You know, it had so much authority. And at some point I realized that there is no Buddhism. And Buddhism has no authority. There is no Buddhism. There's only Buddhist teachings that can point us back to our heart. And so then I turned my attention then away from Buddhism, you know, the thing out there that was going to do it for me, to doing the inner work for myself here. So I think it's not so hard to see how people, you know, we don't have necessarily rivers, sacred rivers here in America, but we have other things that we go to that externalizes the source of change, how we're going to change and become better. And for Buddhist spirituality, the central aspect of it is taking responsibility for the quality of your own heart, your own actions, and working to purify it. So this is his response to this Brahmin. Then, as part of this discourse, the Buddha gives a simile, and this the simile of the cloth. And it goes like this. Suppose a cloth were dirty and stained, and a dyer dipped it in some dye, whether blue or yellow or red or pink. It would look poorly dyed and impure in color. Why is that? Because of the impurity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is defiled, unhappy consequences are expected. Suppose a cloth were pure and bright, and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or pink, and it would look well dyed and pure in color. It would look well dyed and pure in color. Why is that? Because of the purity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is undefiled, a happy consequence is expected. So it's a nice little simile. So, you know, some of you know the famous Zen story of the poor professor. These professors sometimes in these kinds of stories don't get treated very nicely. And the professor goes to visit the Zen master and Buddhist professor, and he comes with all his ideas about Buddhism. He's going to ask questions. But before they begin, the Zen master offers him tea. So the professor holds up his cup to receive the tea, and the Zen master starts pouring the tea in, but doesn't stop. So it pours over the side, and the professor says, it's full, it won't take any more. And the Zen master says, yes, in the same way, you're full. And you can't take any more of my teachings because you have all your filled with your ideas and all that. So, you know, or if we're agitated or we're filled with anxiety or filled with greed, you know, when the mind is preoccupied in very powerful ways, it can't take anything in. It can't take teachings in. It can't practice. It can't really do the inner work that's, you know, purification that's possible. This is kind of similar, is related to that. But then the next section, I think, is what points to how in Buddhism the importance of knowing for yourself. And we know that. I mean, many people in the West talk about Buddhism. They like Buddhist religion because it focuses on, you know, trusting your own experience, knowing for yourself. But it's a little bit naive sometimes when people talk about, you know, how, you know, Buddhism says I'm supposed to know my own truth, know for myself. Because it's naive because people will often justify anything that they remotely have an opinion about as being, I know, or this is, you know. But the Buddha did say, emphasize knowing for yourself, but it's emphasizing a particular way, particular thing that you can know for yourself that's particularly useful. And this next section points to what it is we can know for ourselves. And so it has a number of steps. So the first thing, the Buddha says, first he asks, what are the imperfections that defile the mind? So he's going to list what these are. Covetousness and greed are imperfections that defile the mind. Ill will is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Anger, resentment, contempt, insolence, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obstinacy, rivalry, conceit, arrogance, vanity, and negligence are imperfections that defile the mind. There's a monk named, a scholar named Venerable Analio, in commenting on this list, he talks about them all being social emotions. And it's kind of a little bit unusual to have this long list of social emotions, things that would happen in our society and in relationship to other people. And remember, the text talked about being a refuge for others. And so what kind of emotions or motivations motivate us in relationship to our social world? And here, it's picking up a lot of them and saying, these particular motivations are not for the welfare of your own mind and probably not for the welfare of the world around you. So first he lists these things. And then he says, and this is the important part of practice, of mindfulness, of the unfolding of knowing for yourself. Knowing that these are imperfections of the mind, he lists each one individually, a person abandons it. So first you know it. You know it in yourself. You recognize it in yourself. That you have these things, greed, hate, rivalry, arrogance, conceit, everything. And then you abandon it. So, of course, easier said than done. But it's a noble and wonderful thing to abandon it, these kinds of motivations, at least to the point that you don't act on them. Because you don't want to act in ways that cause harm to the people around you. So at least kind of be able to step aside and have enough mindfulness and presence that they're not dominating or motivating you with what you do. So the person abandons it. Then here's when a person has known that these have been abandoned. At least each one individually. You don't have to abandon the whole lot all at once, but each one. The person then acquires perfect, the translation here says, the perfect confidence in the Buddha. So what's interesting is that the reference point for having confidence in the Buddha, trust or faith in the Buddha, is your own experience. The own, in the language of the ancient world, you've purified your own mind of particular unwholesome, unuseful, painful states. You've kind of figured out how to let go of it. And to see the difference between a mind which is churning, agitated by greed, hate, and delusion, and one that doesn't have it, is a very powerful observation. And this is one of the primary things that the Buddha was emphasizing that you could know for yourself. You could know whether your mind is greedy. You could know whether there's ill will or anger, resentment, contempt, insolence, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obstinacy, rivalry, conceit, arrogance, vanity, and negligence. You can know this stuff about yourself. You know it's there, and you can know that it's no longer there. This is spiritually efficacious and important in Buddhism. We're not talking about believing or knowing some metaphysical or transcendental experience or state. We're focusing on knowing something that is relatively simple and straightforward, something that hopefully is accessible to all of us if we're tuned into it, if we're paying attention to this level of our experience. Now, the word that Bhikkhu Bodhi in this translation translates as perfect confidence, I don't think it's the right translation. He translated it as unwavering confidence in a different edition of the same book. But even so, it doesn't quite represent what the original Pali is. It represents a little more the commentaries, the later tradition, what it says this means. The word that's being translated as perfect or unwavering is avicca. And avicca, I know some of you don't know Pali, of course. Some of you know the word Vedas, has a meaning of knowledge or knowing. And Vedana also has what you can know directly. Avicca has the meaning of knowledge. And the word for a confidence is a beautiful word called pasada, which is related to the word serenity or lucidity, and involves, sometimes it's translated as faith, a confidence, a faith that has a serene or lucid quality to it. It's not fiery faith or fiery confidence. And so the dictionary defines this as faith, trust, confidence based on knowledge. And so I think that gives a very different sense than perfect confidence. You know, how do you know it's perfect? But the idea that now you have confidence or faith or trust based on something you know yourself. It's when you know something for yourself, then you have strong, unwavering confidence in the Buddha. So the Buddha is not someone that you have, you know, just blind faith in or just hold in esteem because it's the Buddha, but rather to understand what the Buddha is about, to understand why he's revered and why people listen to him, requires us really to understand something about our own potential. And it's our own potential that's relatively simple, and so simple that some people will say this is just psychology as opposed to religion, because it doesn't have, you know, to be free of greed and hate and avarice and rivalry and all these things. They don't have the kind of aura of spirituality or great religious truths and oneness with the cosmos or God or something. You know, it's like my therapist wants me to do that. But don't let that fool you or confuse you to think that this is not talking about something quite profound and very deep. We're talking about a state of ultimate state of liberation, which is, at least from a Buddhist point of view, some of the deepest forms of spiritual experience anyone can experience, have. So then it goes on and says, one also will have then trust based on knowledge in the Dharma, and one will have trust based on knowledge in the Sangha. So here this idea of this, these are the refuge things, things we have faith and trust in, but it comes out of our own knowing. So, we're getting to love. So here we have faith, we have refuge, we have knowing for yourself as part of the themes, right, that come together here. But now we're going to get into love. So you're waiting for this, I bet. Where is the love part? When a person has managed to abandon what this text calls the imperfections of the mind, the defilements of the mind, things like torment the mind that cause suffering of the mind, and in doing this has acquired confidence or faith in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha based on their own knowing, like this, then it says the person gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, Dharma, gains gladness connected to the teachings. So it isn't just that you have confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha based on your own knowing, but knowing this potential, knowing this possibility of this transformation in ourselves gives inspiration, gives happiness or some kind of gladness or delight that, yes, there is a possibility. I'm not stuck. There is a possibility. There's a path to walk. There's a way to unfold. There's a spiritual life to live that can transform my suffering, transform me, so I become not only no longer suffer myself, but I can become a refuge for others. It has this description where it's, the assumption here is that once you start kind of getting into this, having this confidence and this trust, and feel inspired and delighted by it, there's almost like the implication of these texts is that because of that, you almost kind of like in the river, and you start just floating down the river if you're in the river. And things that unfold, inner unfoldment, this inner change, begins happening kind of on its own, a natural course. Partly by why the tradition calls the first stage of awakening as a stream enter. Once you enter the stream will carry you. And so here it says, when one is glad, when one is delighted, joy is born. When one has joy, the body becomes tranquil. One whose body is tranquil feels happy. And one who feels happy, the mind becomes concentrated. And so having a concentrated mind or concentrated heart is considered to be very important for the unfolding of this path of Buddhism. But rather than something we do huffing and puffing, here it describes a process by which the deeper concentration happens in the wake of first doing some kind of inner work for yourself, of abandoning, letting go of some of the preoccupations of your mind, which are troubling to have. And taking the time to be delighted by that. What it means is that when you're able to let go of something, no longer be caught up in something, don't just quickly move on to the next thing on your agenda. You know, some of us have a lot of things to do. But take the time to enjoy that. Take the time to be nourished by it, to let it register. Because as you're nourished and let it register, then it's possible, and allow yourself to feel glad and inspired by that. Take the time to feel that, to appreciate that. And then perhaps some of this unfolding, being in the stream, can start happening and perhaps you'll be carried along. And the deeper states of concentration arise out of being calm, relaxed, and happy. And this is one source of relaxation and happiness. So then it describes that so a person gets concentrated. But what do you do when you're concentrated? It's nice to be concentrated. And what's that like to be concentrated in this way? If it happens naturally, without a lot of huffing and puffing, more like an opening to something, what happens when we relax deeply? When the body, it talks about the body relaxing, becoming tranquil. And we feel happy in a relaxed, present way. We're allowing something to unfold within us, as opposed to be the agent who's going to make the change. What's that experience like? What happens? So here's a description. One abides, pervading one direction, with a heart imbued with loving kindness. Likewise, a second direction, likewise a third, likewise a fourth. Likewise, above, below, around, and everywhere. To all as to oneself, one abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind or heart imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. So the answer to my question is one has love. Here it's called metta or loving kindness. And this has been my experience in meditation practice, to my surprise, that at various phases of my deepening into the meditation path, I found that my heart, my inner life, started to sing or vibrate or resonate or radiate or something, first with compassion. And I was quite surprised that compassion was born. I wasn't trying to do it. I wasn't thinking about it. No one told me that I was supposed to be compassionate. And I wasn't interested in being compassionate. Please, no. But as I sat with my own suffering, as I opened to my suffering, as I opened to my experience, the crust of my heart, the resistance, the tension, the distractions, all the stuff that was kind of kept me from being in touch with myself fell away enough that then something, what it felt like to me is something from inside could radiate, could flow. And in the early years of my practice, it was compassion. Then later, when I started doing Vipassana practice, then what, to my surprise, bubbled up inside, from inside, was loving kindness. And I wouldn't describe it with these, in this kind of very, dramatic expression here, abundant, exalted, immeasurable. It's, I was a little bit more modest than what I felt. But the fact that it was kind of flowed up, and when they talk about having it go in all directions throughout the world, what was remarkable to me was to have feelings of compassion, feelings of love that didn't have an object. It wasn't because, I was thinking about someone. And, certainly I could have that. But here it was love and compassion that had no object. And that was one of the big surprises, that just a state of being. Imagine, just a state of being of love, a state of being of compassion. And so that's why I think it feels like it just kind of radiates in all directions. And then it goes a little bit further, and it says that even this, it doesn't say it exactly this way, but even this, these beautiful states of love and compassion that are so boundless, shouldn't be taken as being ultimate. But rather, even this should be investigated, even this should be practiced with and be mindful of, and to be seen how itself these states are conditioned phenomena, these states that there is something more to experience and something beyond them, something which is even less conditioned than this objectless compassion and love. And this would be the deepest, deeper layers of just dropping away, of abandoning any kind of self-reference that consciousness could have. And to have our awareness, our consciousness, be radiant, be present in a full way. So in a sense, you know you're, you know, but But that knowing has no self-reference, meaning no self-reference to a self, to me, myself, and mine. Something drops away in that experience that then a person knows the mind, the heart, is liberated, is free. And then the Buddha said, this is called one bathed in inner bathing. So if you want to go bathe, you know, so kind of in response to this Brahman, who talked about bathing in a river, the Buddha then presents a path, his own river, a path for the inner bathing. And it begins with doing your own work to begin recognizing and then letting go or dissolving the forces of our mind and heart that trouble us. Seeing that it's possible to let go of these things and have a heart and mind untroubled by these things, be inspired by that, have confidence and faith in that, and in that inspiration of that, hopefully feel glad and happy. And let that happiness carry you to relax deeply, to relax in this world, not be on guard, don't be guarded or tense. Be happy, if you can. And then with that opening up into concentrated states, perhaps you'll experience love and compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity. But don't end there. Don't take that as being ultimate. Keep letting go until you have the experience of the heart being liberated and free. And that's your inner bathing, the inner river that you can follow. And this is also the way that you can make yourself a refuge for all beings, which is a beautiful thing to do, an expression of compassion. So in this text, in this sutta, the spiritual practice of Buddhism is clearly put in the context of our social lives. It's put in the context of being a refuge for others. It's put in the context of practicing or experiencing love and compassion for others. And it's put in the context of overcoming the kind of inner mental forces and motivations where we are liable to cause suffering on others. So I think that's a beautiful thing. And so that's the way one sutta covers love, faith, trust, refuge, knowing for yourself, and liberation. Okay? So we have our tea today. Everyone's welcome to stay. And I think it'd be very nice if you would please just turn to someone near you. And even if you've been here the first time ever, you've never been here before, welcome the person next to you and say hello. And then maybe go to tea and...